From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our topic on this edition of the program, more analysis of the 2020 U.S. election results and their implications for the U.S. political landscape. Our guest, Elaine Kmark, Senior Fellow in the Governance Studies Program at the Brookings Institution. That's a prominent policy group here in Washington. She is also the director of the Center for Effective Public Management at Brookings. Elaine Kmark specializes in American electoral politics and government innovation and reform in the United States and abroad. She was last at these VOA microphones back in March of this year during the Democratic primaries. Since then, not only did former Vice President Joe Biden emerge as the Democrats' choice for nominee among about 18 or so contenders, he has since been projected the winner of the November 2020 election. Notwithstanding U.S. President Donald Trump's refusal to recognize these results, even though President-elect Biden has garnered more than 270 electoral college votes needed to win the presidency, this has not prevented Mr. Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, the first woman of color, and the first Asian American to be elected to the second highest office in the land, from forging ahead with transition efforts. According to VOA's Ken Bredemeyer and Catherine Gibson, quote, key Republican leaders in Washington are siding with President Donald Trump and his uphill legal battle to show that vote counting fraud is widespread enough to overturn the projected presidential election victory of Democrat Joe Biden, unquote. After attempting to verify Mr. Trump's claims of electoral fraud regarding mail-in ballots, the New York Times reported this week that no evidence of any major voting issues has emerged. New York Times reporters contacted electoral officials in all 50 states. In addition, election attorneys say that it is highly unlikely that any lawsuits will affect the outcome of the election. They add that recounts planned in some states are also unlikely to change the outcome. Well, we'll talk with Elaine Kmark, who is also a lecturer in public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government and member of the Democratic National Committee, about these and other developments like down-ballot races. We will ask her why the Democrats lost seats in the House of Representatives, even though they maintained their majority. We will also look at the balance of power in the Senate, which depends on the outcome of two high-stakes runoff elections in the southern state of Georgia in early January 2021. Elaine Kmark, the author of many books, including Primary Politics, Everything You Want to Know About How America Nominates Its Presidential Candidates, joins us via Microsoft Teams. Elaine, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me. Thank you so much.
And as a longtime Democratic activist, Elaine Kmark, what's your assessment of the 2020 U.S. election results that have projected that former Vice President Joe Biden and Senator Kamala Harris are now President-elect and Vice President-elect of the United States of America?
Well, I think it's two things. Obviously, Democrats like myself are very, very happy that the Trump era has come to an end. We're pleased with the breadth of Joe Biden's win. He's got a significant Electoral College victory and a significant victory in the popular vote. But we were kind of artificially buoyed by the early polls. And I think a lot of Democrats, myself included, expected that there would be more change in the down ballot races, that there would be a pickup in the House of Representatives. Instead, there was a loss. And we even dreamed of getting the United States Senate, which could still happen, but it's really, really, really close. And as you indicated in your introduction, it depends on two Senate races in Georgia. So we're happy, we're relieved, but our expectations were higher. And I think some of our expectations have been dashed.
Well, we'll talk about some of those down ballot races and why there is this discrepancy between reality and hopes. But what about the turnout? I mean, this was a high voter turnout in the midst of a pandemic. Even as President Trump and Republicans were trying to delegitimize mail-in ballots and even hamstringing the U.S. Postal Service, what does that say about the electorate and their interest in this election?
It was a very highly mobilized electorate on both sides. I mean, President Trump's voters really turned out. I mean, and they turned out on Election Day just exactly as he had asked them to do. Joe Biden's voters turned out in mail ballots. Lots and lots of ballots came in early. Every state broke records for the number of mail-in ballots. And that was, of course, a function of the pandemic and people not wanting to go out to polling places, to places where they'd be with strangers. And so this was a huge turnout on both sides. And the numbers aren't really in yet, but we may have the highest turnout in a century in American politics as a percentage of eligible voters.
And speaking of the unprecedented number of mail-in ballots, just as Mr. Trump and many Republicans were telegraphing in the run-up to the election, they seem to want to somehow undermine mail-in ballots, saying somehow even in the midst of a pandemic, they were illegitimate, even though we know Mr. Trump votes by absentee ballot. Nonetheless, what do you make now of President Trump's refusal to recognize the results, which are quite decisive, as you said, in terms of the Electoral College, which may even increase, that is, Mr. Biden's numbers of Electoral College votes are likely to increase in some states. And that is, of course, what determines the presidency, as well as Mr. Biden's decisive national popular vote, which is, again, growing in Pennsylvania, in Georgia, and even in Arizona and Nevada. What do you make of the refusal to recognize these results?
Well, it's, again, one of the kind of mysterious things that this president has done. It's not surprising. This president has defied conventional wisdom from the very beginning. He marches to his own drummer. He doesn't seem to have any interest in respecting the norms of democracy that other presidents have had. He views conspiracy theories all over the place, and he is particularly skeptical about elections. So in 2016, when he was winning Republican primaries, he was totally skeptical and saying the system was rigged, which people were sort of scratching their heads and saying, but you're winning. In 2016, in the fall, when he was in the general election, he persisted in saying that the system was rigged and that he would not concede if Hillary Clinton won the election. Again, it was like with no evidence, just sowing mistrust all over the place in order to protect himself and his ego should he lose. There's a little bit of odd psychology going on here, and I almost never talk about psychology in the midst of politics, but Donald Trump, remember, hates losers. The worst thing he can say about somebody is they're a loser, and he's always calling his enemies losers, whether they're in the press or other politicians. He's totally disrespectful. Psychologically, he can't admit that he has lost. And so he's going to have to play out every last possibility. He's going to believe in every conspiracy theory, no matter how vague the evidence, because this is going to be a hard thing for him psychologically to take into account. If we look at other presidents who've lost in close races, look at Al Gore, the grace with which Al Gore conceded after the Supreme Court ruled against him in December of 2000. Most politicians have enough self-security in their own personalities to say, okay, well, I did everything I could, I lost. For Donald Trump, this is a very difficult thing to do. So a lot of what we're seeing is him just playing out something that he needs to play out. And a lot of people going along with him, understanding that, yeah, he needs to do this and eventually it will stop.
So tell us when you think it will stop and what are the implications of President Trump and many Republican lawmakers not recognizing President-elect Biden's victory and how that is going to affect this important interregnum, the transition to January 20th?
Well, my guess is that it will stop on December 14th. December 14th is the day in the Constitution when the Electoral College meets. Now, this bizarre system goes as follows. The electors for the winner in each state meet in the state capitol, and they sign what's called a certificate of ascertainment, which is a quaint 18th century term, saying that they, as an elector, vote for Joe Biden or Donald Trump. Those get sent into Washington, D.C. There's actual paper that does go, and to the United States Senate, and the president of the Senate announces this on January 6th. When those Electoral College meetings take place on December 14th, we can assume, for a variety of reasons, which I can get into later, we can assume that the winner of the state has won the Electoral College and that the Democratic or the Republican electors have signed the certificate and sent it on. At that point, it's really over. Okay, at that point, there's a process in the Constitution for the Senate to meet and open the ballots and formally declare the president the president. But at that point, it will be hard to pretend that Donald Trump has won. And so let's look at what that means for this transition period. Usually, a losing presidential candidate concedes. They may not concede right away, particularly if there's votes being counted, et cetera, but they do concede and give a concession speech. When that happens, usually, the head of the Government Services Administration, GSA, goes ahead and says, okay, the transition has begun, and releases $6.3 million to the winner for transition activities. Now, that's not an awful lot of money for a big country. Usually what it goes to pay for is office space and telephones and things like that. Well, as you can see from behind me, we're all working at home. Nobody's in their offices anyway. We're in the middle of a pandemic. So it's certainly not going to impede the progress of a Biden transition that they are not in an office together. I suspect you'll see Joe Biden doing a lot of Zoom calls with, you know, prospects for his cabinet. I wouldn't be surprised if he was doing it now. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that the official transition provides for the winner to send teams into the government agencies to get briefed on, you know, what's going on. Well, on the domestic side of the ledger, and that includes dealing with the pandemic, you know, Joe Biden doesn't really need to get into the agencies. I mean, there's no secrets in those agencies. The Center for Disease Control publishes information on COVID infections on a regular basis. So do the other agencies. The guidelines for when we get allowed for a vaccine to be distributed are public at the Food and Drug Administration. So it's not going to really affect Joe Biden. And in fact, he's proceeding quickly to draw up a COVID plan for when he takes office. The third area is the one where there could be some problem, which is on the national security side. The President-elect Joe Biden is not getting the president's top secret briefings, nor is his national security team being able to proceed getting their security clearances so that they can be read into sensitive intelligence. So that is a potential problem and cause for concern, which is that they may be behind a bit in catching up with the, you know, various brewing crises around the world that we may or may not know about. So that is a problem. But basically, the delay, which will probably be slightly more than a month before we do a formal transition, isn't really slowing down Joe Biden. He's giving press conferences. He's meeting with teams. He's looking at personnel. He's proceeding with the transition.
Exactly. And he's received many congratulatory phone calls from world leaders.
Oh, yeah. You know, usually you need the State Department to set those up. There's a certain protocol, et cetera. I'm sure they're following that protocol because his foreign policy team has been in the State Department and they're quite experienced. And yeah, he's talking to world leaders. He's talking to potential cabinet secretaries. He's planning all the regulations he's going to reverse that Trump put in, and I'm sure Biden will sign a whole raft of executive orders reversing regulations very, very quickly. So he's doing the work.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Elaine Kmark, founding director of the Center for Effective Public Management and senior fellow in the Governance Studies Program at the Brookings Institution. And she joins us via Microsoft Teams as we all continue to practice social distancing during this coronavirus pandemic. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a big shout out to one of our most loyal listeners, Kashia Johanna from Kaduna, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. So back to our special guest, Elaine Kmark. And Elaine, talking about President-elect Biden's enormous experience as both a vice president and a senator, he really knows how government works. He's, as you said, going forward with his transition, as is Vice President-elect Kamala Harris. Talk about the meaning of the historic significance of Kamala Harris as vice president-elect. She's a woman, as we said, a woman of color, of Indian descent. You know, you wrote an interesting article back in August entitled, "This is Not Your Grandfather's Vice Presidency." And this was, of course, before she was elected. Discuss the historic significance and how the office of the vice president has changed in the past 30 years.
Well, it used to be that vice presidents were chosen in a nominating convention before the era of primaries. And what often happened in the old days, and I'm talking pre-1972, is that a leading candidate would need votes to get over the top, over 50% or two-thirds, depending on the rule at the time. And that leading candidate would look around for things to bargain with. And of course, the biggest bargaining chip was offering somebody the vice presidency in return for the votes of their delegates. Now, practically what that meant was oftentimes the president was choosing a vice president from a different region of the country or a different faction of the party or both, which meant that for much of our history, we had some pretty dysfunctional pairs of presidents and vice presidents. We had presidents and vice presidents who didn't like each other and, in fact, weren't politically on the same page and, in fact, spent their time undermining each other. And some of those stories are pretty funny. They're in my book, Picking the Vice President. That all changed in 1972 when we started picking presidents through primaries. And the result was that presidents, particularly beginning in 1992 with Bill Clinton's selection of Al Gore, stopped picking vice presidents to balance the ticket. And so they started picking vice presidents who were in tune with them ideologically, who were from a part of the country, regardless of whether they needed that part of the country for the ticket or not. Look at Joe Biden's own selection. He was from Delaware. Delaware has all of 3 electoral votes. It's one of the smallest states in the country. It's reliably Democratic. Obama didn't need Joe Biden for political purposes. He did need Joe Biden because Joe Biden had extensive foreign policy experience, particularly in Iraq and Iran and those conflicts, and he wanted him to help him. So that model is now a more of a partnership model than it is a political balance model. And I think what we saw with Biden was there was a little bit of the balance model just because women are so much more supportive of the Democratic Party than men are. It was pretty clear all year long that there would be a woman on the Democratic ticket. And then after that, it boiled down to a question of race. Could you find a woman of color to also give more of that political balance? But also just plain old compatibility. Is this person somebody that Joe Biden can trust? And is it a person who is more or less ideologically attuned to Joe Biden? And the reason that latter is so important is that modern vice presidents take on big responsibilities themselves, independent of the president. So Al Gore ran Reinventing Government, and he ran the telecommunications reform, which is a big deal. And the president simply said, whatever Al thinks, that's what we're going to do. But it can only happen if the president trusts the vice president and pick somebody with whom they are very comfortable. So I think that's how Joe Biden arrived at Kamala Harris, it was safe for Biden to say early on, as he did, that he was going to choose a woman because we now have a sufficient number of women in the Senate, in governor's offices, that you can't argue about their experience. But I think that beyond that, it turns into a question of trust and personality and who do you want to have as your partner doing a very, very difficult job.
So let's turn now to the Congress. Elaine Kmark, the blue wave that many Democrats were hoping for didn't actually materialize. Instead of gaining seats in the lower chamber of the House of Representatives, they lost a few seats. Now in the Senate, the Democrats didn't win a couple of endangered Republican seats like that of Maine Senator Susan Collins. She kept her seat. Joni Ernst of Iowa, they were hoping to snatch those two, but they didn't. Right now, as we said, the balance of power in the Senate depends on these two runoff races in Georgia. But I'd like to get your take on what chances do the Democrats have. Georgia is leaning Democratic right now. Joe Biden may be declared the winner in Georgia. Explain first this discrepancy between Democrats' aspirations and realities.
My take is that there were a lot of sort of swing voters, Republicans, who were kind of disgusted with President Trump, who is not always what we think a president should be and doesn't act like a president often. And yet they were very wary of the Democratic Party and particularly the left wing of the Democratic Party. Particularly two terms were quite frightening to them. Socialist. America has never been big on socialism, even though I know that many other countries are. Socialism here is a bad word, not quite as bad as communism, but almost as bad. And this funny term, which still bothers me that they used it, called defund the police. When you look at what black leaders were actually talking about, they were really talking about taking functions away from the police that were not related to crime and stopping crime and giving them to other places. For instance, in all American cities, the police have the job of getting a homeless person who's perhaps sitting in the middle of a sidewalk and is kind of shouting at people, et cetera, but it's not a crime he's committing, but the police have to go deal with that person. And they're saying maybe the police should just worry about crime and order, and we should have other agencies worrying about, for instance, homelessness. And so that's what it meant when you talk to them. But this terrible terminology of defund the police led people to think, oh, my God, when somebody's breaking in my window over here, nobody's going to come because they're going to take all the money away from the police. It was just awful. The left in America really needs to learn how to talk to the rest of America because all they do is scare the living daylights out of them.
That may be true, but on the other hand, analysts say the Republicans exploited the term socialist, although people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's a liberal Democrat from New York, of course, Bernie Sanders, the senator, even though they claim this so-called democratic socialist label, it has no resemblance to the socialism of, let's say, Venezuela or Cuba. But I think that the Republicans conflated those very successfully.
But remember that that is a subtlety that most voters don't get. The difference between democratic socialism and socialism, it's way too subtle a distinction to make. Therefore, it was easy for the Republicans to do this. And every time somebody on the left tried to defend democratic socialism, all people saw was they were defending socialism. In politics, you just can't make those fine distinctions. And defund the police was another one that really hurt Democratic candidates in swing districts. I think a lot of Republicans said to themselves, okay, I can't vote for this guy Trump, but I want to make sure that the left wing of the Democratic Party is checked. And that's why I think that Democrats lost House seats and really haven't gotten very far in the Senate.
What about these two Senate races in Georgia? Do you think the Democrats have a chance of winning those seats? And what does that imply for the Senate?
They might be able to pick up one, okay? And then that would make it a very, very close Senate. I think it might be like a 49-51 Senate. And then we'll be in a situation where the question will be on critical issues. Are there enough Republican senators who will bolt, especially with Donald Trump no longer in office, and occasionally support the Democrats? There are four senators that have already called to congratulate Joe Biden and who have said that they think it's wrong what Trump is doing. And you can look at those four in a very closely divided Senate and say, well, you know, maybe there's a possibility that on some issues there could be bipartisan coalitions made. And that is, I think, a tricky thing to do. But Joe Biden spent a lot of years in the Senate. So if there's anybody that could pull this off, it's probably Joe Biden.
So let's say the Republicans prevail, as you said, perhaps getting one of the two runoffs in January. That means Mitch McConnell returns as majority leader. Do you think it portends more gridlock, and would it stymie President-elect Biden's domestic agenda? Or, as you alluded to, would Biden's relationship, very strong relationship with the Senate, with Republican senators, Mitch McConnell in particular, could that help prevent this type of gridlock? Would Mr. McConnell be more collaborative somehow behind the scenes? Would he be more likely to compromise?
Oh, I think for sure. I think actually, ironically, we've already seen some hints of that. Prior to the election, they were not going to give any state and local government relief in a COVID bill. Not going to do it. Suddenly, the day after election, Mitch McConnell says, yes, possibly we would have state and local relief in the bill. So I think we're already seeing it. And remember, a lot of this depends on what happens to Trump and the Trump voters, right? When Trump is no longer in the Oval Office, things will change. I think he'll still be a very powerful voice in American politics, but he will not have that incredible bully pulpit that the presidency is. So remains to be seen how Republican senators especially will view opportunities for compromise. There may be enough of them that we will have some compromise on some issues.
And as we close, Elaine Paymark, let me ask you about December 14th one more time. To what extent you think that will be a critical date after which those who have refused to recognize the 2020 U.S. election results will sort of say, okay, because the electors are certifying the election. Do you think there might be still any chance for any type of manipulation whatsoever? And then finally, how do you think our electoral infrastructure fared, especially during this election, the unprecedented number of mail-in ballots? Many analysts are saying, hooray to our election workers, the election officials in all the states, that they have done yeoman work and that it shows that, you know, our electoral infrastructure, notwithstanding many shortcomings, it has proven to be quite solid and credible.
On the first point, it will be very difficult after December 14th to say that Donald Trump won the election. I mean, almost impossible. I'm sure there will be some hardcore Trump supporters who will continue to insist that it was stolen. But the end is there. I mean, that is the end of this process, is when those electors sign their certificates and send them on to the Senate. In terms of the election administration, it's remarkable. One of the remarkable things is what a small percentage of ballots were messed up. I myself said, oh, lots of people will be voting absentee for the first time, and therefore they're going to make mistakes on their ballots. There's going to be ballots that are set aside as provisional or will have to be sent back. In fact, that number is very small, and election officials have been surprised at it. In addition, states were worried about the post office delaying election mail because of the shenanigans of President Trump's postmaster general. So people really mailed in their ballots ahead of time. And so in Pennsylvania, even if all the ballots that arrived after Election Day are thrown out by a court, it still isn't enough to make any difference in Joe Biden's majority, and he'll still win the state of Pennsylvania. So we're very pleased. In addition, we did not see Russian or international intervention in this election, in the election apparatus. There was plenty of disinformation, et cetera. It's a little hard to separate the domestic disinformation from the international disinformation. But in terms of penetrating election systems, they seem to have learned the lesson from 2016. The states seem to be ready and up to the job.
Elaine Kmark is Senior Fellow in the Governance Studies Program at the Brookings Institution and author, of the acclaimed book, Primary Politics, Everything You Need to Know About How America Nominates Its Presidential Candidates. Elaine, thank you again for sharing your insights, this time about the results of the 2020 election and, of course, their ramifications for our political landscape.
Thanks so much for having me.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.